Welcome to the Retro Computing Roundtable, show number
52.
Black to white, but no matter where I go, there's one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
It is Sunday, June
9th,
and I am joined, as always, with my co-host, Earl the Pearl Evans, but unfortunately, without our usual co-host, Dave Grealish, who has been pulled away. So it's just going to be a two-hander today. It's going to be me and you, Earl. I'm going to have you on the spot. And the first spot I will put you on is to ask you, how you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Okay.
It's lovely and sunny. Yeah, thanks.
Sunny, holy cow,
the hard questions are coming. The hard-hitting journalism.
Today in Toronto, it is about 21, 22 degrees, bright, sunny outside, fluffy clouds. It's amazing. Perfect, perfect weather outside today.
What temperature did you say? Can you convert that to
American? 21, which would be low 70s, I guess, in fake temperatures. That's like 73.
Beautiful.
I guess. It is, yeah. It's just perfect weather. It's a wear anything you want weather, but also very sunny, and loved it. Alas, I am stuck inside today.
Well, only for a little while.
No, I've been inside most of the day.
Oh, okay.
Outside, it looks beautiful for the people who are allowed out, who are not pale like me.
Yeah, they don't let us out much.
Yes. So, we are going to begin the show. Let's get into some retro computing talk. And once again, I'm going to stick you on the spot. Because, as always, we have a host's topic. And I'm the host, so this guy with these two thumbs, he gets to pick the topic. And the topic I've picked, I am entitling Unfinished Business. And by that I mean, or I want to ask you, and then I'll discuss as well, what retro computing game or project or what have you never completed, but you keep telling yourself you're going to? So we're not talking about things that you tried and didn't like or tried and gave up on or what have you. It's something that you keep fooling yourself into believing that is still part of your life and you're going to come back and one day complete it, although the years go on and you never have. I got a few of those. What about you, Earl? Got anything like that in your retro computing life?
I probably have more of those than I have the completed projects, but
isn't that the way?
I can think of some right off the top of my head. For one, forever, I've been trying to build a virtual disk drive for the Epson PX8 computer.
We have discussed that, yes.
And the upshot of this is that there is software that you can run under Linux that will emulate a disk drive for the PX8. And it works really well. It's been updated within the last few years. Very nice piece of software. I would like to take that same approach, but put it in a smaller package with a microcontroller or some other sort of miniaturized device so that it could run off batteries, it would be portable, it would be essentially like the PF10 drive was for the PX8 many years ago.
Right, right, yes.
Now,
but you haven't done it.
I haven't done it.
But you
fool
yourself into thinking you will.
I got close. I got the Raspberry Pi to run this software, which took a little hacking of the source code. But the Raspberry Pi doesn't have a real solid standard battery type of unit yet. And so, yeah, why do I think I'm going to finish this? I just think I am. I tend to have faith. And then another
foolish blind faith.
The networked Othello game that Reversi.
Right. Yes,
if I don't say Reversi, I'll get sued.
The non-trademark game, which you podcasted about. Yes.
Yes. And what else? Oh, and you know, I think that part of the reason that I don't finish these is that I come up with other projects, and then I want to do those projects. So it's like the muse is bouncing around, pulling me in different directions, going, no, Earl, come over here. Do this. This is more
this
fun.
This is shiny. Yes.
Yeah, my friend a couple days ago gave me, one of the retro buddies at one of the club meetings, gave me a nice 386 system. It's in a ginormous AT-style case. You remember those? Big metallic.
Yep, absolutely. One of the iconic cases. Yeah, love
don't
it.
Get crushed underneath it kind of case.
that is true.
And one of the problems is I'm holding in my hand, because most people listen and don't watch, a Dallas DS 1287 real-time clock chip.
I see it. It even has a little image of a clock on it.
Now,
so
here's
the issue.
I believe
you when you tell me what it is.
This chip is a combination of a real-time clock CMOS settings memory, non-volatile memory, a crystal for the time, and the battery that runs it.
Okay.
Here's the problem. That's all in this one plug-in chip.
So the battery is eventually going to die.
When the battery dies, you got to replace the whole chip. Now, these things were made in the 80s when you could just go out and buy this chip. But
so
now...
a little basket of acid right now.
Now you can't.
You're splashing around inside there?
So what I have to do is on the side here...
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, most people listen, but and there's some websites that'll show you this if you're really interested, which why would you be unless you had one of these chips, but you can dig into the side of this chip and get to the pins where it attaches to the battery that's buried within this kind of all integrated unit. And
right.
Then you chop that out and hook up an external battery and you're good to go. All the rest of the chip continues to function.
Cool.
But see, this is yet another project that I want to do. So that this Intel 386 system comes alive, and it's a great 386 system with 8 megabytes of RAM and not
wow,
really.
Holy crap! That's a lot of RAM for 386.
I know, really good condition
do with all that RAM?
Unit. You just rule the world.
And why wouldn't you?
So you know that I think that's one problem that I have with projects is I just need to have the discipline to knuckle down and go, okay, I need to buy tools for this project. Mm-hmm. Don't go buy something else. Buy the tools that I need. Okay, I need to take the time for this project. Don't go, oh, wow, time, I'd rather be doing something else. Just, you know, finish it. I mean, at work, they make you do things like actually finish projects. But when it's a hobby, you've got nobody standing over your shoulder going, finish, 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 kind of thing.
Good point.
What about you, Carrington?
Oh, my gosh. I'm in the same boat as you. Same boat as you? Yes. You and I are in a ball and a boat. Not a ball and a boat.
I thought we were in a round table.
And there's a round table with a ball on it on a boat. A lot of people don't know this, but our production.
And there's only enough food for one of us.
And I'm going to eat you. So I'm in the same boat for the same reasons. I get distracted easily. Something will seem really, really appealing, and I'll hit the first speed bump. And while I should just knuckle down and try to get past that, there'll be this other thing saying, but I've got all the exciting things that you've been thinking of now. Come and work on me. So it does happen with me quite a lot. Outside of retro computing, I've been really good at controlling that. And I instituted a rule for myself quite a few years ago where I can't think of anything current if I haven't worked on it for at least 1 hour in the last month. So every last month, did I spend an hour on it? No, then it's not something I'm doing. It's something I used to do. It's something maybe I will do once again in the future, but it's no longer a current project. And by not thinking of it as current, being able to flush that out, I had fewer things that I was, you know, so-called working on, and that helped whittle it down. Even so, when it comes to hobbies, I will sometimes not apply that rule the way I will for the rest of my life. But there's been a few things that haunt me, for want of a better word. There'll be particularly games. As a kid, I wouldn't finish most games. I loved adventure games. I still sucked at them. I kind of suck at them now. So I have played far more games than I have completed. I start adventure games. I get in. A puzzle seems difficult. And unless I cheat, I'm not going to finish. And then the game just stocks, and I always think I will come back to it. But there's been a couple of games that for some reason gripped me, and I couldn't finish them. And I refused to cheat, but I'm still not playing them. Games. There's a game called Mask of the Sun, which is a graphical text adventure game that I played a little bit of. I had a pirated copy of it as a kid, so all I had was a floppy disk, nothing else, no instruction. And the instructions for adventure games normally don't help you out much anyway, other than maybe
right.
Getting past the first puzzle. You're kind of on your own for those. But I had no manual. I had no box. I had nothing. I just had this disc that I stumbled on. I think I had a box of discs I came into, and on it was just handwritten label that said Mask of the Sun. I popped it in, and for some reason, it just gripped me. You're down in Central America, and you start off really early that you're in a Jeep, and you have to try to find your way to a pyramid. I think I only got like that far. Couldn't even find the location of the first thing. I got nowhere in it, but for some reason, it gripped me, and I refused to cheat. I refused to look up a walkthrough, and I also couldn't finish it. This is a game from, I don't know, 82, 84, so a long time ago. I still haven't finished it. It still haunts me, and every once in a while, it'll come up on eBay, and every time it does, I bid on it, and every time I'm outbid, I want this game internet, and I want an actual real copy. Like, it's something I will feel a real sense of accomplishment if I can get a real box copy of this game and play through it. The game probably sucks because I never really got that far in, and most adventure games from the period aren't really that great. but for some reason this game just gripped me, and there's something about it that makes me want to complete it. But I want an actual copy, and I can't get a stinking copy of this game.
What happens? Is it Rare? Who's it made by?
I don't know. It was some. You know what? I don't even remember. I think it was published by like Datasoft or something, so it probably sucks. It's one of those things where it's not that rare.
It may be anticlimactic when you get it in actual.
Oh, I'm certain it will be. And I don't think it's even really that rare a game. It's just that it doesn't come up that often in a completed version. So usually it's just there's a disc, and I want the whole package. Ideally, I want a sealed copy, and then I'd be willing to really bid on that. But I want an actual copy of the game, which I've never owned, and I want to finish that stupid game, which I've never done. So there's a couple of games like that that just for some reason, because it's a hobby, not a work thing, you don't have to let things go if you don't want to. And so I want to finish this game, and I'm doing it for pleasure, so I just never stopped wanting to finish it, even though it's been like 30 years now. I still haven't done so. But one day, eBay and I will come together, and I will get a copy of this game, and I will complete it, and it will be a happy day in Carrington Land.
You know, it's interesting when you mentioned, though, like going through it and doing it. I know that some folks who do these projects, especially retro computing projects, they're not even all that interested in using the end result. They just want to do the project and see if they can accomplish it.
Sure.
I was talking to a guy up at the Seattle Computer Club that they have up there, and he's a really good hardware engineer. The guy's a genius. But when he would create something, then once it was created, he wouldn't sit around and play with it a whole bunch. It was just the actual building of it, either the engineering of it or the construction of it or something like that. And then once he got that far, then he was done. So, and although I love CPM and I really, really like the PX8 Epson portable computer, if I were ever to finish this portable virtual disk drive, I'm not sure how often I would use it.
Now, does that impact why you're not working on it as much as well?
Boy, I don't know. I think, actually, the thing that probably threw me off the most was, you mentioned speed bumps.
Mm-hmm.
I hit a serious speed bump in terms of the construction of this. And it threw me off so much that I think I just never cycled back around to try and do it again.
Mm-hmm. That happens to me a lot. Where I'll get lazy.
Yeah, this is probably the best way to describe it. And I think the people who do come out with these cool projects that we look at, like the CFFA 3000 and other hardware projects, some of the ones for the Commodore, there's a gentleman, Jim Brain, who makes a ton of different hardware add-ons and sells them in his retro store for the Commodore series of computers.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy has what I would say is the gene that I don't have in my DNA to actually complete this hobby project and then actually use it and make it available to other people.
I mean, a lot of times I think that's what separates people that do accomplish those things. I remember talking to somebody because I wanted to write a novel. He said, well, the difference between people who have written a novel and people who haven't, people who have written a novel wrote a novel. And what he meant was just that you sat down and bang it out and get it done and you become the guy who wrote a novel. So I think it's the same thing. So I just got to say, but it's hard to get motivated when you're not being paid to do it, when you got this little tiny sliver of free time, like in my life.
Right.
And sometimes I'll think, well, do I want to spend 3 hours now trying to bug fix this thing versus start it, like the appeal of starting the new project? Oh, I love to start a project. So.
Well, you know, I'm getting up there in years, but I still have faith that I will somehow find that gene. I will like splice into my DNA the ability to finish these hardware projects, the just do it gene. Yeah.
Nothing can happen. Nothing will go wrong if you just start splicing into your DNA right now, live on camera. Or do it.
No, in fact, I already have.
Excellent.
The process is ongoing.
Horns starting to grow.
Yeah, if a third ear starts growing out of my cheek, just ignore that.
Well, or a mouse with an ear on it. You could take it to the whole other level. Have a flashlight and a mouse growing out of
right. If I start looking like an episode of Fringe, don't mind me.
Nice. Okay, so let's get into the news, shall we? I think the first couple, since it's going to be just you and me now, you are going to talk about the RISC OS. So what's going on with that? Something about pies and arms and what?
Well, so here's the deal. In the late 80s, Acorn made the Archimedes set of computers, and they were based on and I believe this is where it comes from, the Acorn RISC machine, or ARM. And
is that where ARM comes from?
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Acorn, the company that made the machines for the Beeb and also made the Archimedes series of computers.
How did I not know this? This is crazy.
That's the ARM legacy. It's interesting. And along with these computers, they had an operating system called RISC OS.
Right.
And
that I've heard of.
As time went on, Acorn made newer and newer computers, and then eventually didn't
anymore.
Well,
they were going to go on and make older and older computers.
Well, yeah, we do.
okay, yes.
So, and then other hardware manufacturers came out with computers that would run this operating system. It had a legacy, kind of a cult following legacy that you might compare, in a sense, to the Amiga line of computers that still go on to this day and run updated versions of the Amiga operating system. And lately, this RISC OS operating system that's continued to be updated, and one fork of it, it's forked into a couple different versions, but one of them is open source and has been ported over to the Raspberry Pi, which also runs an ARM chip. And so I loaded it on the Raspberry Pi, and I'm trying to figure it out, and it's idiosyncratic, right? It's not Linux, it's not Windows, it's its own operating system, and so I'm going through and figuring out the peculiarities of it. I think it's really cool, actually. Not only that, but I think it's kind of fun to be running this modern operating system that is a throwback to when the ARM chip started, when that whole architecture started, and now runs everything, all our smartphones, our tablets.
Kind of a weird thing. It's almost like coming across an animal that took its own evolutionary track and said, here, look at these modern dinosaurs at the top of this plateau. It's like, what?
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly
crazy.
And it's fun. It's fun to learn about it. So I'm running it on my Raspberry Pi. It's really easy to install. A little
bit
easier.
Where could, if somebody's interested in this, where could they find it?
All they'd have to do is go to raspberrypi.org, and they would find that as one of the available operating systems for their Pi.
Excellent. This, and we'll make sure that we have a link to that in the show notes. I'll remind everybody that, yes, we do have show notes, which you can find at rcrpodcast.com. So you can always find everything we talk about. Every single thing we talk about is posted there, if
Indeed.
We remember to include the link.
Including gene splicing.
Including, of course, before and after pictures of Earl and his ears. Nice. Well, that's really exciting. Now, I see that the next bit of news is also from you. This might be a running thing in this show because I was very late.
Well, I stole the bullet point from David, actually.
Oh, good. Ah, suck it, David. We're doing the show without you.
We're so, here, you're so, there.
So what is this? A documentary, and this is going to be particularly of interest to me because I do love my games. And it's a documentary about early UK video game industry. Is that correct?
From Bedrooms to Billions is the name of the documentary. You can go to their website and you can see a trailer. It purports to talk about the history of the video game world in the UK, which up to now I know almost nothing about, but was obviously a gigantic industry. Lots of people made a lot of money, very interesting turns and twists.
Right.
And apparently this was another one of these indie-funded documentaries. I think the site that I was looking at, or one of the ones that it was linked off to, was Indiegogo.
Sure, I was going to say it's probably Indiegogo or Kickstarter or something like that.
So. I think they might have done a combination of funding, actually.
Okay.
But the film is not yet released, from what I could tell from their website, and I was having a hard time digging up what the projected release date was, which was a little bit of a bummer because based on the trailer, I was really excited about what they're going to present.
No,
I just want to let people know
about
it.
So it's something that you'd see online or get on DVD, presumably, not that it would be a theatrical release.
Correct. And you could get it, apparently I saw three different ways to buy it, direct download, DVD, or Blu-ray.
Okay, but I wonder if the DVD comes only in PAL, because that might be an issue if it's a UK thing.
Hmm, interesting.
I doubt it'll be region code locked, but I wonder if it'll be a strange encoding.
That,
it might be
something
if you're out here in North America, it's safer to go for the digital thing. I'm not that keen to have discs lying around anyway.
I don't need the physical media for most things.
I have so many DVDs, and all I've really done is rip all those movies and stick them on hard drives, and it's so much more convenient to have a couple of hard drives than baskets and baskets and baskets of 2,000 DVDs.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So that's what's up with that.
Okay, and so that's at frombedroomstobillions.com. So I'll make sure we have a link to that in the show notes as well. Now, I have a bit of news, though it's not actually my news, but something that I found really interesting, and I stumbled on something on Reddit. So I like Reddit.com. It's a great way to waste time when you're at work and you don't want to be at work. You want to be playing on the internet. Reddit is perfect for that. In fact, I think it would be really interesting to, because with Reddit, I don't know if you frequent Reddit, but there's subreddits, and they're like sort of topical discussions. So I view Reddit as like a little mini new version, a web-based version of Usenet stuff. There's the particular topic threads that I'm interested in, and I just follow those. And so I think you can probably, it'd be very interesting to see with any given person what their Reddit login looks like, and like what are the subreddits that follow. You can probably know a lot about somebody because mine's a lot of weird and retro things.
About their personality.
So I find it always very interesting because you can do that, and because you basically can subscribe to Reddits and subreddits, and then they become what you view on your homepage. It's showing you all the news, but it's showing you only the latest things that have been voted up from the subreddits that you subscribe to. Because it's a very interesting thing, because if I go to a regular news site, if I'm hanging out on the BBC or something, then I'm seeing world news, and I might be interested in some sections more than others. I'm more interested in general world news than I will be interested in like entertainment news, say. But I'm still seeing, you know, the news of the world. But when you get a little more insular, when you subscribe to something in Reddit, you're just seeing the things bubble up that you have pre-subscribed to topic-wise. So it becomes more and more like the world is really interested in the things that you're interested in. And it becomes less like, hey, you've got weird taste. It's more like, yes, let us all gather and discuss this. So increasingly I find, because I'm more and more sites I'm setting up that way, so when I view them, they're showing me what I'm interested in. One of the weird things that comes from that is it appears like the general world news is about the weird niche topics you're interested in. For instance, what became a big deal in the world, it seemed, was that there was a PDP-8E, that it had been, you know, there's a YouTube video and it's been brought back from sort of from the dead and see that. And so not only is the computer interesting and much smaller than people were all commenting on, I can't believe how small this is compared to what they thought these things looked like, and it's really interesting to see the video. We'll have a link to the video in the show notes. But what I found interesting about the topic itself was I didn't realize at first that this was a very small, barely noticed, barely commented upon event in a corner of the internet. It appeared to me like a whole bunch, like it was just front page news that this had happened, because I went to so many sites and everything, the big headline was PDP-8E is alive. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe the news is so interested in this computer. And then it took me a minute to realize, no, it's not. I've just put filters on the world that will trick me into thinking that my niche interests in retro computing are general interests shared by the rest of the world. Nobody else at work would be aware of this the way I was. So I found both the video itself about the PDP-8E, and if you're interested in PDP stuff, it's a great video to watch. It's really fun to see this come to life. But I thought it was also an interesting comment that you can, with the internet world, really create a worldview filter that will trick you into thinking that the world sort of agrees with you. And I wonder how much, it was the first time I realized I was doing that and not realizing it. And I wonder, how much does that happen on a broader level where I filter the general news and political news and so many things to think that the world is in line with me versus just general stuff? And so it really made me aware of the danger of setting preferences and setting filters. And maybe, you know, if you want to see real world news, you should just have a whole other browser that doesn't enable cookies. You just head off to new sites in general. So anyway, it kind of messed with my head.
Well, that's true. And things that'll start to focus in on you also might not just be limited to the news, but entertainment. Mm-hmm. For instance, with Netflix, they see what you've rated, what you've watched, and then when you look up something else, they'll give you a, you know, this is 3.3 stars predicted for Earl.
Oh, yeah, because that's right. The star rating is for you, not in general.
Right. So the danger is I could miss something that would be super interesting to me because they didn't know that I was interested in, like, the genetic makeup of toads.
That's why it's very important that you tell companies everything about you all the time.
That's why I do. Yes. I pretty much publish everything to everybody. So.
The Earl Cam. At earlcam.com, go. Like, people don't realize that the web broadcast we have going right now is just that like little hour-long thing. But you are actually sitting here 24 hours a day, every day. We just cut in for 1 hour to share with you.
That's right. It's like the Truman Show. But the, what else was I thinking? Amazon, stuff that you want to buy. Mm-hmm. They look at what you bought. eBay, same sort of thing. They look at what you do, and then they present to you other things that they think you might want to buy. Based
sure.
on that, which is cool. I understand why they're doing it.
Exactly.
But and with the Reddit thing that you're talking about, you've actually intentionally dialed it in to try to get what you want. So,
I hadn't really.
Every now and then, we just got to go Periscope up, right? And look around, or maybe log out of all the sites so they don't know who you are.
But
and
at the same time, there's also something pleasant about it. Like, I get so much junk mail at my house, for instance, that companies are paying a whole bunch of real money to send me glossy flyers. And tell them ahead of time, I'm like, it goes from there to the garbage. And I get that that's why it's called junk mail. But the reality is I wouldn't mind receiving it if it was about something I would be remotely interested in.
That's
but the
true.
Vast majority of stuff I get, because companies can't know. So they just send it to everybody in my postal code or everybody in the city or what have you. But when they're trying to send me stuff about cruises or about, I don't know, certain types of furniture or certain types of restaurants, my mind isn't open to it. So I'm like, well, that's a waste. And I would prefer if I went to the mailbox and opened up and it was all things of incredibly, you know, fascinating interest to me. I'd be very happy to receive that junk mail. But why, yes, I am interested in this new, you know, Harley Davidson grip line or something. Mm-hmm. Like, these are the things in my life that I actually enjoy. So I don't know, I guess, but it really hadn't hit me how much I was doing that and filtering what I'm exposed to and not really realizing that really changed my views on things. It was much more insidious than I thought. And I wanted to use the fact that it was also a very interesting PDP video and people should go off and see it. So we'll have a link to the YouTube video.
Very nice. Speaking of YouTube, are either one of us watching to see if we have any comments?
I'm hoping that you are.
I wasn't, but I can.
I'm hoping that you will be. I may be host, but I just send people off to do things. I was running late. So yeah,
why don't you go ahead and talk about the... What's that?
I was just going to tell everybody, just in case you're wondering, we are recording late this week. Not just the 1 week late because of last week, but a little bit late today, even from the regular schedule. Because of me, I was stuck in traffic. Darn you, Toronto traffic. So I was texting Earl, using voice to text, so safely. But I was sending you email, but speaking it into my phone, hoping the punctuation came through right to give you updates that I'm crawling along the DVP and hoping to get here for 4.
I am bringing this up while we speak. I think the next thing is your topic, is it?
Nope, it's you. Most
Me
of the topics
again?
Are you. I was late. I didn't have time to look up news.
This says that we're live now.
We are.
And here it comes. Okay.
Hello,
comments. some good comments here. UK video gaming, the pence goes into the left coin slot.
Right.
Grumpier Than Thou says Mask of the Sun was great.
Thank you. I'm glad that you said that, because I'm hoping it's going to be good, because one day me and that game will come together.
Says he remembers it fondly. Not sure if he actually finished it, though.
I'm like that with most adventure games. Most adventure games, I love them. I love the whole category of game. But the vast majority I have played, I have not finished.
And Vintage Volts indicates, I have a basement full of the bemused projects. Yep. Yeah, it seems to be something that we're all suffering from.
Oh, and speaking of Vintage Volts, I can say it live, congratulations. He won the contest that we had on No Quarter. So he's getting miniatures replica video game cabinet, video game cabinet, made from somebody in the UK, actually, who custom makes little replica cabinets with working 1.5-inch LED display or LCD displays. So it displays GIFs of the actual game. So I think he's selected a Tron game. So he's going to be getting a Tron game from the UK.
Oh, how fun.
I know, totally awesome. I want one, too. So when we, I think, actually, we've already placed the order, but... I think I might place orders for more because I want some of those.
And it looks like that Mask of the Sun might have been Ultrasoft Broderbund.
Oh, okay. Then that makes it more likely that it is a good game.
And Vintage Volts, this is kind of funny because this has happened to me. He says, buy something for your teenage daughter from Amazon, then see what kind of stuff they recommend for you.
That's funny, too, because I had a friend stay with me for a couple of days, and she is really interested in what's called overlanding. So I guess that's when you go out and you like live in a Jeep or 4x4 stuff, and she goes out to the deserts, and they build. She has this custom camper thing made by a company called Sportsmobile, and it's basically they take a 4x4 thing, and they make the interior to what you want. So you design it, and this whole custom-built thing with this popping top and a shower built in and all these weird things. So and so she was staying with me for a few days. And after she left, the ads I would see on the internet changed dramatically. I saw tons of ads for RVs and that kind of stuff.
Interesting.
Yeah, just because of that history. And even after clearing out cookies up, no, it stayed with me. So it's funny how that also changed the internet for me, just having somebody else sit down for a few days and borrow your computer.
Profiled.
Suddenly I'm getting a lot of ads for Winnebago and stuff. Like, hey, where'd that come from? So I had an overlander staying with me. So, yep.
Oh. Well, what's the next thing?
The next thing is a fun 5-minute video with Amiga co-designer Dave Needle.
Oh, yeah. And this video? This video? Sorry, video. First day with my new mouth. This video. It was from the 90s.
Right.
So not too long after the fact on all of this. But mm-hmm. It was interesting getting some of the inside scoop on the development of the Amiga and what went wrong. There's a lot crammed into that 5-minute.
What did you get a sense from it? What Dave Needle thinks went wrong with the Amiga? Did he admit that something went wrong? And that's the reason it didn't take
off? Yeah,
because
I think
people
it was,
who love the Amiga loved the Amiga then, and they still love the Amiga now. And yet the Amiga kind of just didn't do anything. I mean, I hate to say it. I know Amiga people will hate me, but I was a Mac fan, so I lived also through the 2% and 3% years. But the Amiga kind of just didn't make it. To me, from the outside as a non-Amiga user, it looked like this amazing computer that Commodore just failed to get traction with, and then it just died. So
yes.
Was there something in the video that explained like why that happened? Because I always kind of wondered. Because everybody, even at the time, it was one of those things where you talk to Amiga people, they'd say, look at my video toaster, look at what I can do. All of you guys suck. I'm so far ahead of the game. And yet the computer didn't take off. So the people who liked it seemed to be very convinced that they had a serious powerhouse there, something that was much more capable than was available for other people, and yet didn't seem to get any market share.
I don't remember if this specific thing was from Dave Needle or just the overall video, but it's consistent with what I've heard from other venues and probably will be consistent with what we'll see in the upcoming book from Brian Bagnell, Commodore the Amiga Years, where he talks about those issues.
Right.
But two things, really. One is that technologically, the Amiga, from both a hardware and an operating system standpoint, was way ahead of the time, way ahead of the game.
And it was a 68K machine, right? So it's similar to the Macs. Right,
okay. And it had true preemptive multitasking.
Oh,
you could do multiple things.
Wow, back then? No.
And it had
really?
Yes. And it had wonderful graphics with bit depths and processing capability that were way ahead of other machines for the same price point. Mm-hmm. It was very, very innovative and technologically advanced. And I don't know, some people argue at least a decade ahead of its time. And that's one thing that you get consistently whenever you listen to someone in the know talk about the Amiga. The second thing is that Commodore marketing and the Commodore executive team was clueless about how to properly market and sell and distribute and also to get the software developers to get traction with the machine. Because one person says in the video, it's like, yeah, I could get this wonderful Amiga, and technologically it's brilliant, but if I want to run a word processor or a spreadsheet, am I going to go with something like Microsoft Word and Excel, or am I going to go with these third-party bit players that make inferior software on the Amiga? I'm obviously going to go with the more premium software. And so Commodore's failure to get a large developer following on board and making a wide catalog of software for the Amiga is one of the things that went wrong. Also, I personally remember I was way into the Commodore 8-bit machines back then. When the Amiga came out, I had no clue where to go buy one.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I mean, there were tons of computer stores in the Los Angeles area. It was almost like Starbucks is today. You couldn't walk down the street and not trip over a computer store. But which of the computer stores had Amigas? They were usually these kind of hole-in-the-wall, specialty niche sort of stores that were in another city that you didn't quite know where they were located. And where were the TV commercials? Where were the newspaper ads? Where were the things telling people, hey, you really can have this innovative and technologically advanced computer? Yeah, Commodore just completely dropped the ball.
Right. Chicken and egg thing, though. Without the sales, it's hard to have the money to fund the TV commercials and all that and to convince stores to carry it. So it is, I mean, we see that today with anything from computers to phones. It's so hard to get traction against something like the iPhone. People will come out with stuff and go, but this is better in all ways. But they say, yeah, but I never heard of it, and it's easy to find where I buy
right.
an iPhone and stuff. So, yeah.
Well, apparently there was some largesse on part of the Commodore executive team, too, if I'm reading it right, that would rather have the money for other playthings than put it into R&D and that kind of stuff, would rather line some pockets.
Interesting.
So,
well, I haven't actually watched this video, but I have now bookmarked it because I'm quite keen to see it anyway. And the Amiga, it has always fascinated me, I think because I've never used one. So anything I don't use but that I hear about always seems to have an appeal to me. It's like, oh, I wonder what that's like.
Yeah, go check it out. It's an interesting, and I like it because it was short.
I like that.
You know, 5 minutes, one and done.
Okay, we will have a link to that YouTube video with the Amiga code designer Dave Needle in our show notes, too. And we're going to round out the news with a choice for me. And I'm quite keen on this. I put it last because I wanted it to be last because I think it's the best bit of news in ages. It makes me so excited. So when I say Alamogordo to you, Earl, what do you think?
New Mexico.
Right. But when I hear Alamogordo, I know it as one thing. The site of maybe the place where in 1983 Atari secretly dumped millions of copies of the E.T. Atari 2600 cartridge in a secret landfill in the city of Alamogordo. Well, excitingly, a Canadian company called Fuel Entertainment has now received permission from the city of Alamogordo to go searching for it. So they are going to be excavating. They're going to be doing a dig. They're just wrapping up the financing now, but it's definitely a go. They are going to be digging in and around the city of Alamogordo to try to find the secret cache of millions of copies of the ET cartridge that were buried there back in the 80s. I love it. And I love the fact that it's a fellow named Mike Burns, who's the CEO, who is doing all the news rounds about it. And of course, he therefore gets referred to as Mr. Burns. So it's all about how Mr. Burns would be digging up the city of Alamogordo.
Excellent.
The whole thing is just so pleasing to me as a bit of news. So
we're going to dig a hole. Give me that Simpson fellow.
Exactly. So I'm totally thrilled. So the notoriously terrible, though not as bad as I remember playing it and hating it, but I've subsequently played it. And if you play it and you have the instruction manual, which is how I think a lot of people got it in Christmas 1982, was it panned, you know, a bad game, but there were worse games, definitely. Subsequent to that, of course, people, for the most part, when you buy Atari cartridges in the subsequent years, you just get the cartridge. This is a game that you kind of need the instructions, because you can't really tell what the heck is going on if you don't have the actual instructions. And so I played it and grabbed a copy of the instructions online. And it's not nearly as bad as people say it is. But still, you know, not a great game. But what's exciting about it is Atari may or may not, they've never really come out and said whether or not they did this, but they may have dumped millions of cartridges in a landfill in or around the city of Alamogordo. And we will soon find out whether or not that happened. So quite an exciting bit of news, I think.
Fun.
I know. I'm so excited. I can't wait. So I've been reading notes about it in the Alamogordo Daily News, which is available online.
You see the archaeologists out there with their brush, you know, dusting off a Atari cartridge.
Totally. So it'd be just interesting to find out. I mean, I have heard about that rumor, I guess, for years and years, since the 80s, there was that big rumor that they did this. But nobody's ever really confirmed, did they or didn't they? And I guess now we will soon find out. Even the guys from Fuel Entertainment said it may be a fruitless day, like maybe they'll search and not find anything, which wouldn't necessarily be conclusive proof, but probably that'll mean there's nothing there.
Or, unless you dig up the entire city.
I know, but they've got funding and they've got approval now, so they're going digging all over the place. So it's gonna be quite exciting. I'm hoping that they find it. Anyway, I'm really excited that this is happening, and we'll have a link in the show notes to a BBC News report, which is where I first found out about it, which itself links out to the Alamogordo Daily News, so you can keep your eye on the project as it proceeds.
Hilarious.
Yep.
Have you experienced the awesome power of the Panasonic Real 3D system? Obviously. Yeah. The intense realism of Panasonic Real 3DO. Apparently. Or the mind-blowing graphics of Panasonic Real 3DO. Definitely.
Cool.
The Real 3DO system from Panasonic.
Some of you believe your system is the most advanced in the universe. Let's review the numbers. Sega Genesis is 16 bits. 3DO is 32 bits. The Atari Jaguar is 64 bits. Which is more advanced? Clifford!
Mm-hmm.
16 and 32 are less than 64. So with 64 bits, 3D graphics, real world animation, and lightning speed that you can only get with Jaguar, which is more advanced? Clifford!
Can you repeat the question?
Jaguar!
Jaguar! Jaguar!
So, next up, we are going to talk about buying things. We're going to talk about things on eBay. But first, we're going to have, as is our tradition, a host's choice gift idea, a retro computing gift idea. And since I'm the host, it will be my choice. And what I have chosen, and I chose this to keep in line with the theme of the many adventure games that I have loved but not finished, has been recently released the Guide to Classic Graphical Adventures. We'll have a link to Amazon.com, where you can pick it up. It's available online in a number of places. You can get it for Kindle. You can get a digital version as well as a printed guide. The printed guide, I think, would make the better gift. This comes from a site called HardcoreGaming101.net, and they have put together this book, which the full title is actually HardcoreGaming101.net Presents the Guide to Classic Graphic Adventures. So I'm linking off to the Kindle edition, but like I said, it's also available as a printed and bound book, which I think would make the better gift. So what I liked about this is it's something that views from a modern standpoint. So this isn't a classic guide that would have existed back in the day. This is something that just came out, I think it was last year, and I just didn't know about it, maybe a year and a half ago. But anyway, it's relatively modern. And it views these classic graphic adventure games, like things like the Sierra Online games, King's Quest, Space Quest, that sort of thing, plus a range of others, and also sprinkles in a few of the retro-style classic games that were released more recently. And it guides you through them. It talks about the game. It talks about it. So it's sort of not really a whole walkthrough on the games, but it is a whole guide to finding them, experiencing them, if you can find other games that you might be interested in. So if you like these adventure games, if you like games like Mask of the Sun, this would be a way to read about the games and discover others that came out that you might not have known about. There's over 250 games from the classic era, basically games from 1984 to around 2000, and it focuses on the LucasArts games, you know, Monkey Island, Sam & Max, and even more modern ones like Grim Fandango and the Sierra Online games, King's Quest.
So it would help me finish Day of the Tentacle?
Well, more I think what it'll help you do is not necessarily even finish these. I think at the end of the day, you and I would still be in the place where we're not finishing most of the games. But what it helps you is, say you loved Maniac Mansion and you loved Monkey Island, it will tell you, you should check out Grim Fandango. Or you loved King's Quest and Space Knight, it'll say, you know, here's other games, because you're able to sort of see the breadth of these games.
I see.
So I see it as much of as a shopping guide to lead you towards games like Gabriel Knight, which you might not have known about if you only remembered the very early classic games. So hopefully, if you know somebody who loves that sort of game, this will let them reminisce about the games they enjoyed and also point them towards more games that they could start and not finish the way that I do. So that is my choice. And it's basically $10. So it's a $10 game, a $10 book available widely through internet, through Amazon. You can still get it new. You can get the Kindle edition for about $9 as well. So yeah, so nice, cheap, good gift, I think, for somebody who likes classic adventure games. So what else? What else could we buy? Or if we turned our eye to maybe classic things available on eBay, for instance, what would you suggest that somebody with some money burning a hole in their pocket and a love of retro computing, what should they pick up this week?
Well, you might be able to buy a rare Lisa 1 that's been converted to a Lisa 2.
Might I?
Coming with a printer and some apps and extras, and the seller claims in this case that everything works and even puts really with two exclamation points. So I think, if it wasn't for the exclamation points, I wouldn't be sure.
Or if it was just one exclamation point, then...
Then I'd be kind of sure. But, I mean, the two totally got me. Here's the thing. It's starting out with a $1 bid.
Oh, that's it. Nice. Good.
Yeah. However, as is with eBay, there's a reserve. And we don't know what the reserve is. I looked at it and I thought, well, finally, somebody who's just going to let the market decide what this retro computing item should be worth. Because I tell you, every time we do the show and I go through eBay, I get that old curmudgeon feeling again, like, oh my gosh, you know, why are you trying to sell this for so much money? Mm-hmm. I mutter some things under my breath and I move on. And when I saw this for $1, I was thinking, well, I mean, obviously it's not going to go for $1. But then I saw that it had a reserve. So who knows if the reserve is crazy.
Now, is there a buy it now option? Can somebody just step in?
Yes, if you want to spend $4,000, you can buy it immediately.
Okay, we know the reserve is less than $4,000, presumably.
We do. And in fact, you know, this may go for a decent amount of money, because if you look at the photographs, this thing is in beautiful shape.
I'm looking at it now. Looking at the manuals, even in the little box. Nice.
And not scuffed up, not damaged.
And it shows it working, which is always nice. I love when people are selling a computer and then they turn it on and show you screenshots.
Yes.
Nice.
There are even some pictures here of printouts from the accompanying printer. And so, looking at this, I think, wow, you've got a really good chance of getting a functional Apple Lisa that's in beautiful shape.
Now, what's the shipping for you? Because you're done. For me, this is $200 to have this shipped to Canada.
$131 to ship it to Portland.
Okay.
So I imagine that, that shipping price. It's a lot of stuff, and you would want to package it carefully.
Yeah.
With something like this, the greatest tragedy would be something this nice gets damaged on the way to you.
Right.
In fact, if I had the dime to buy something like this, I might even pay them some extra and have them even take care of it more in the shipping. Some sort of like one of those liquid foam fill sort of things that I've heard about where...
A friend of mine was having
a number of Commodore PETs shipped and went with one of those things where you put the item in the box on top of some shipping material, and then you spray it with this stuff that immediately hardens into a custom form.
Yeah, foam in place. The sealer makes it like the two different.
Oh, that's right. You have a shipping company.
I know all the shipping. Through that shipping company, I was just talking to somebody who's going to be shipping some Commodore things from Canada down to the States. And one of the things he's shipping is something I'd never even heard of before, called a microwatt. MicroWat, which I guess was the University of Waterloo made this computer that became the precursor to the SuperPET. And so it's called a microwatt. And so there's going to be a microwatt shipping from Canada to the States.
Oh my gosh, I bet that goes for a pretty penny. The SuperPETs themselves actually get a decent amount on eBay when you see them. And it was fascinating how they had that collaboration with the University of Waterloo to come up with a computer that they could use to do local programming and then upload to the mainframe.
I didn't know anything about this either. It was all news to me. So because he brought up the microwatt, I've been spent this last week reading about it because I've been out of the Commodore world. So it's like, oh, this is all fascinating. I had no idea that there was that business with the University of Waterloo, which is only an hour west of Toronto. So I'm well aware of the University of Waterloo. I've taken a number of classes there, actually.
Oh, nice.
But, this whole microwatt, I was like, what the heck is this? Not a lot on the internet. that about it. But yeah, quite exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing it, but he was saying I will be disappointed. Is it because I like Apple II? He said no, because it's not much to look at. I guess it's just like a small box with no display or anything, and it's just so all it is looks like a power supply with ports. So it's not really exciting to look at. But
a precursor.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it will be that he's got that and a PET and a few other things shipping down. So it was the microwatt that really caught my eye because I'd never heard of it before. So
wow. So what
cool.
do you have,
so what do you think this Lisa one will go for though? What do you, what would
oh
your,
my guess?
Your guess? Yeah, because right now it's got one bid. It's going for $1.
I wish David was here.
David would know.
One of the only times you'll ever hear me say that. just kidding, David. Come on, you can take a joke. $1,700.
Wow, really? Did it go for that much? Holy
crap. I think this one, in this condition with all this stuff, could possibly go for that.
Right. I guess if you wanted a Lisa,
but that's not an endorsement of this particular. You got to understand, I don't know the Lisa market. I'm just looking at this thing and going, wow, this is fully functional. It's complete. It's got, you know, all the goodies.
I mean, it's got all those manuals, like for Lisa Calc and Lisa Graph and Lisa Draw, in that little binder full of all those books.
If you wanted, and with the Apple mania that's been happening lately, and if you wanted the Insta collection of Lisa, so what do you think? What's your guess?
The thing is, I was going to guess like $600 or $700. So I guess I don't know. I was like, yeah, this might go for $600 or $700.
I think it'll go for more than that. Watch, it goes for right in between.
Well, speaking of going for stuff, though, I think in our last show, which was a million years ago because we missed our regular scheduled week, I had picked as my eBay auction. We'll get to my eBay auction for this week in a second. I haven't forgotten. But I picked last week, I think it was an Apple IIc that had been mislabeled. Like they were saying it was only the bottom part of that. And I was saying how that's a good thing to look for because when you look for things that are described wrong, so search more broadly, like search for just Apple and that kind of stuff in vintage computing, and keep an eye on the things that look like they're either in the wrong categories or the wrong description and go, oh, hold on, that's where you get the real bargains. This does well. Like the Apple IIcs lately have been going for, you know, you see them online, they want $300 or $400. It's crazy just for a regular normal Apple IIc that's all yellowed. Like why is that a $300 item? It's bonkers. But this one that I picked, I think it went for something like $25. So like that's the way to find these things, is look for stuff that in this case was just being promoted as the bottom half of the computer. And if you have knowledge of the thing, go, no, that's the whole computer, you can pick them up for a song. So somebody got themselves a real bargain for that Apple IIc last week, or last show rather. So this week, I am going Apple, which will surprise everybody.
Oh my goodness. You totally went a different way with that.
But I am, in a sense, going a different way, and then I'm going CPM, but I'm going CPM inside an Apple. So this is another example of why I'm using my latest picks to teach people about eBay and to broaden your market. So a lot of times, being a Canadian, a lot of things are listed on the internet, or listed on eBay in America, and people say that they won't ship outside of the States. Well, then I don't get to bid on you. What are you doing? Like, why not? Even if it's going to be expensive, open it up to the rest of the world. So when you're searching eBay, you should generally look not just in your own country, but look around because you never know. Here's something that is in Germany. It's an Apple II CPM card, but it's a whole kit. And right now it's €6.50, but it's been recently listed, and it's already got 4 bids. So I think it's going to go for quite a bit. But it's a nice system, and as far as I can tell, because I can't read German, it includes everything you would need to get online. It's got the floppy drive pair. It's got all the software. It's got a CPM card. It's got the card to run the two floppy drives. It's basically, if you want to run CPM in your Apple II, this is the way to go. It also has some sort of video 80, which I assume is just an 80 column card. I don't know, I got to translate this listing, but it looks really fascinating to me. You get 10 disks each of 3.5 and 5.25, but you get a floppy disk controller, you get the Z80 card itself, or Z80 cart, as they say in German, it seems. But it looks like a full, you know, turn your Apple II into a CPM one wonder box kit, as far as I can tell. Right now going for only €6.50.
Very nice. And did you ever do that either back then or now? Have you ever run CPM on the Apple II?
I have run CPM, but never on an Apple II. So, but what I like about this is, like, you can turn. I'm all about, you know, one machine that can do other things. My probably my favorite retro computer I have at the moment. If I could only pick one, it wouldn't actually be any of my Apple IIs. I've got a 2E, a 2C, and a 2GS at the moment, and maybe one spare one, I think. But I don't have a lot. And even those, I'm going to pare down, because how many computers do you need? But my favorite one I have at the moment is my LC6.
Right, because you've got the Apple II card.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Quadro 605, which is the LC475. That's what I have, LC475, because I have an Apple II card in it. So I get vintage Mac stuff, runs System 7 and System 6 great. Mostly System 7 is what I run on it, but it can even run faster things. And it has that Apple IIe card, which basically is like a 2C. It should have been called a 2C card, but it runs actual on-the-disk 2Cs, can take screenshots. It lets you use modern monitors because it's really easy to get a vintage LC to work with a modern display because the old Mac pinout, just with a little tiny pin adapter, will run VGA, and it's still very simple to get computers that will run VGA.
So that is nice.
Big old monitor, and it's so hard to get a modern LED monitor to work with a vintage Apple II, but it's really easy to get one to work with a proper pinout Macintosh. So an LC475 makes a great way to run Apple II software on a big LCD display, and I love it. So, and again, I like the fact that I live in my little condo here, and I can combine multiple retro loves into one box. So what appeals to me about this sort of thing is, as well, like if I like CPM, which I don't think I do, but if I did, then I would want to run it inside another computer that I also like, rather than have a dedicated computer. So 6.5 euro. I have no idea what this will go for, because I have no idea how rare this is, but I like the fact that it was a full kit, just like your pick. I like things where you say, if you get this, you're done. You don't have to get this and then go searching for drives, or get this and go searching for a controller. You just get this, you have the software, the drives, the card, the whole shebang, including manuals, including everything. So I like it.
Yes, it is nice to get something
and
complete.
Yeah.
I like the, I hope my microphone isn't making a bunch of sound here. I'm noticing.
It's a little scratchy.
Move my jaw.
Don't move your jaw when you speak. We can see your lips move.
Okay, I'll talk like this then.
We bring David on next level. So.
It's one of the reasons that I like the Commodore 128, because I can do my Commodore 64 stuff on it, or you can do the 128 with the better BASIC and nicer stuff, or you can run CPM on it. It's like three computers in one. And so it takes up one little spot in my retro table, but I can do a whole ton of stuff with it. So, yes, likewise. And, you know, Grumpier Than Thou said in the comments, $4,000 he doesn't think is all that crazy.
Really? So they actually go that high?
Wonders if it won't actually go for the buy it now.
So, bonkers. Holy cow. So people will actually drop $4,000 on
I guess we'll see.
Whew. I guess it does. The problem is it's one of those things where, yeah, I'll have a good sense of value of things that I'm interested in, and, you know, quasi-collect myself. Like, I can look at a game and think, oh, that's too high for an Apple II game, or that's a good price for a sealed game. But when it comes to something like Elisa, I have no idea what a good price would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is true. I mean, David would be the better person to ask on this. So maybe
thanks
offline.
Thanks for letting us down and not being on the show, David.
Yeah, we'll see if we can get his guess ahead of time. And then this is why we don't typically do this anymore, but the next time we do the show, I think we should probably talk about what this went for.
I like it. Cool. So any other comments we should address before we get to our closing discussions?
I don't think so. Not for me.
And not for me either. So what about, let's wrap up a bit. Earl, what's new? Got anything to share? Any closing discussions you want to bring up?
Oh, goodness.
Let's talk about goodness.
Well, you make me think about all the projects that I'm not finishing. But one of the ones that I am going to finish within the next couple of days, I'm pretty sure, is...
That sounds like a commitment to me.
Yeah, that's a real solid maybe, is getting the first episode of Chicken Lips Radio on the air.
Excellent. As a person who's ready to subscribe, I would like the first episode of that. Come on. As a Mac guy, you're going to be my entrance to the world of the Chicken Lips, so you'll have to convince me what I've been missing. I'm looking forward to that, Earl.
And I had got some positive comments back on the first episode of Next Without 4 that I did on DBase 3. So,
yeah. As you should. I am really excited about that as a podcast as well, because I think there has been a dearth of that sort of thing, like looking at programming, and like, oh yeah, so I love it. I love the whole idea of that podcast.
Well, and I'm going to tell you that podcast is partially your fault, because when we talked about it, I don't know, 2 months ago or something like that, about doing programming, you made the comment, I'd listen to a podcast like that.
Yep.
So
you got at least one listener, because I'm very keen.
It's all your fault, Carrington. And, of course, you know, I have to drill holes into my real-time clock chip and try and fix it and finish reverse E and make a virtual disk drive.
Cool.
And what else is going on? Just enjoying the beautiful weather here, as apparently so are you. What about you? What are your closing remarks, parting shots?
The big thing that's exciting for me is I got CC65 working on the Mac. CC65 is a cross-compiler that I looked at a few different times. And so what it's supposed to let you do is take C code, type it in, compile it, and end up with a working program on a vintage computer. So if you want to write for Commodore, you want to write for, basically for things for, I think, 6502s, for a bunch of different chips, I think. But for me, it was, if you want to write C programs for the Apple II and end up with a compiled, finished program, CC65 is the way to do that. So you enter C at one end, out pops from the other end a finished, compiled Apple II program. So that was the dream, but I could never get the stupid thing to work. There was, like, every time I tried to get, and it was pretty frustrating because I'm a programmer. I know the Apple II. I'm supposed to be able to do these things.
It's a combination of the documentation and the it was tough for me too. I have got it to work for the Commodore. I understand what you're talking about, the challenge of trying to figure out how the tool chain actually works, what you pass in, you know, how you get the right stuff coming out the other. So
frustrating. So finally, I stumbled, it was really, really bugging me. Like, I kept coming back to it, and it kept never working. Then I had a bit of incredible good fortune. I came across a long post on Mac GUI City, so Mac GUI City. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I can't tell from looking at this, I'm looking at it now, I still can't figure out who the heck posted this? Because I'd love to thank them. It says, like, when it got posted, but I don't know who posted it. So somebody posted a guide to compiling Apple II programs in C with C65 and the Mac OS X. So it was exactly a guide for exactly what I wanted. I run a modern Mac with Mountain Lion, and I want to be able to type C code, and I want to end up with a working Apple II program. Mm-hmm. And this guide, and I will put a link in the show notes to it over at MacGUI.com. It's article number 761, or just search for compiling Apple II programs in C with CC65 and Mac OS X. It's the perfect guide because it says, here's what you're going to need. Here's what to install. Here's how to check whether it's been installed 0.1. And then it's a step-by-step guide. Go through this. Copy this, paste it into. And what you end up with at the end is not just, okay, it's working, you're on your own. He sets up a couple of little scripts that walks you through doing, and it's so perfect, because what you end up with is you can open up the terminal, or in my case, you can cut and paste things from I like to work in BBEdit. So you have a single terminal command, which is just going to be make, and so you just go to what you just move over to the right directory that you've got your stuff set up in. You type in a plain text file your C code. Then you just execute the command make, and what pops out now, it compiles, creates a disk image, launches Virtual 2, loads it, and runs it. It's amazing. So you just type it in, click make, and then you're viewing it on an Apple II, a fully compiled program. You make your bug checks and just go back, and it's a perfect bit of workflow. I just absolutely adore it. It's amazing. I will definitely be doing something at Kansas Fest in C for the Apple II because of this guy's posting. So excited.
Beautiful. And what you're describing is the exact bridge that got built for me to be able to do the same thing with the Commodore, because somebody made a corresponding make file that you could run, and it would do exactly what you were talking about, build the executable, and then launch it on the Vice emulator for Commodore devices. And
there's nothing here that I couldn't do. Like, it was all easy to follow, but there kept being little things. There's something about C65 that wouldn't compile.
Little things that you stumble over, right?
Little things
make file,
driving me crazy. Yes.
That make file approach combined with CC65 tends to take care of it. So that's just awesome. And I'm glad that that's out there for the Apple. That's so cool.
So it's just one of those things where you can get Xcode, which if you're a developer, you'd already have, but or else you got to go out and just, you know, download that from Apple. But it's just, it's fantastic. Like, it's such a great workflow. And I'm Well, the Apple II, of course, has a really good built-in BASIC, and I could work in BASIC. I'm actually better in C. I've done a lot more in my life in C than I have in BASIC. So, and I wanted to work on something, and I want to work on something that will compile and run a little faster, because now I'm used to my big bloated software now. It's hard for me to write something in BASIC on the Apple II. It'll run so slow because I'll want to throw things at it that it'll just choke on. I was working on a text adventure language parser, which was what got me back into programming. I want to write a text adventure game. So the ideas behind that, be able to take a sentence, just parse it, find, like, just look for the space as tokens and parse out the number of words, and then look those words up against the dictionary and say, is this a verb? Is this whatever? Just the lookups and the string searches took so freaking long in regular BASIC for the Apple II. I was like, that's going to kill us. I'm going to have to do this in assembler, which I guess I could do, but it puts a barrier in to say the only way to do this was in, you know, 6502 assembler. And now instead, C is not a great language for strings, but at least it compiles and I get, you know, decent speed out of it. So
right.
It's quite exciting. It's opened up a whole world of Apple II development for me that didn't exist before. So I want to make sure I called out. And I'd like to thank whoever the heck wrote this thing. I just don't know who they did, but they are awesome.
Very cool. And I'll also make sure to mention that along with the corresponding Commodore make file that I found on the Next Without 4.
Excellent.
That'd be perfect.
Yeah, so let's get links. I've got a link to this. I'll make sure in the show notes over at rcrpodcast.com. If you're interested in doing this, if you want to use a modern Mac and write software for the Apple II, I strongly urge you to go read this because it'll walk you through really simple steps. And bingo, you've got a simple workflow where you just type it in, hit save, and out pops a disk image with your program already compiled on it. It's fantastic. So, well, we'll link to that in the show notes. And I guess that wraps us up. So our next show is going to be...
Before I do that... Some closing comments.
Comment. Hit me. Comment, people.
Vintage Volt says he's supposed to be able to run CPM on the TRS-80 Model 4, but hasn't figured out how to do so. That's true. I know that will run on a Model 4, and I don't know how. But I'm... but I can give you a little bit of validation that, yes, that'll work.
Supposedly.
And another question, are there a bunch of machine-specific libraries in CC65? Yes, there are, indeed. Yep. And also, you'll find that other people have written source code that they have open-sourced that then give you even additional capabilities for whatever is the platform that you're on.
Absolutely. So
Apple, Atari, Commodore, exactly. Yes.
And if you program in C, you'll know that it'll work with libraries. Like, you'll have standard I.O., that kind of stuff. And so you just refer to those libraries. You have your program, and you're just going to bring those in the beginning. So a lot of people have written libraries, just like you're asking for, specifically for vintage computers, including things like there is a low-res and a high-res graphics library for the Apple II. So you can just sort of reference that, and then here's a bunch of commands to do graphics on the Apple II in C, on a modern computer. So now you just basically have new commands, and it's just a library. No, it's fantastic. Really, really, really good. I'm very excited about the opportunities that CC65 will offer me now. So.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Now
we're done.
Okay, yeah, now
so
we're done.
Now we are wrapping up. And our next show, and thank you very much for listening to this show, but our next show will be Sunday, July 7th. So we hope you will join us then. As always, we will be recording at 4 p.m. Eastern, which is 1 p.m. Pacific, unless we're a little late like we were today.
And why are we not doing a show 2 weeks from now?
Are we not doing a show 2 weeks from now?
Well, that's not July 7th.
Oh, no, it's not July 7th. Why does it say July 7th? I was reading from the...
It should be June 23rd.
We will be June 23rd. Yes, so Sunday, June 23rd, and also July 7th.
Yes, although I won't be here for the July 7th. You guys got to replace me for that one.
Woohoo! Finally, it's going to be just me.
I'm going to be in Tokyo on July 7th.
Oh, that's right. So. That's right. And then 2 weeks later, we will be recording on July 23rd, and I might not be on that show because I will be at Kansas Fest.
July 23rd?
July
21st.
21st, we record. Oh, no. Yeah, we moved our week, and that's why. I won't be at Kansas Fest. I will be getting ready for Kansas Fest. Losers, I'm going to Kansas Fest.
I wish I could
Which is
go
the
also.
Official slogan this year of Kansas Fest. I'm going to Kansas Fest.
That's
I'm
nice.
I'm going to get that on a t-shirt.
See, since Ken's not doing the messaging anymore, they've kind of opened it up a little bit, right?
So, to wrap things up, you can find everything we talked about today, all of this, including the Mac UI thing for CC65 and the videos and all the news that we talked about, you can find in our show notes, which, as always, are available at rcrpodcast.com. vintagecomputer.com. You can also join us in a forum. So we use the vintage-computer.com's forums, but you don't have to memorize that. You can just head over to rcrpodcast.com, and there's a big link right there to go discuss everything in the forums. You can interact with us on Twitter, because we like to interact with people. You can find us at RCR on that funky social network program. You can email us if you want. You can send feedback to us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. There are so many ways to get a hold of us, and we love all of them. And best of all is if you head over to iTunes and help people find us by leaving a little comment or even just rate the show, because that helps it bubble up and then people can find us and interact with us as well. Thank you very much for listening this time, and for those of you who joined us in the live broadcast on YouTube, thank you very much. Good to see you guys. And until next time, as always, I will say, Retro Compute! Thanks for listening.